So I'd like to welcome on to the show Kerris and Susan Ayton. How are you doing?
Hi, thank you.
Good stuff. Thanks for coming on. I don't know, Susan, if you want to start and just give us your background and then tell everyone how you've arrived at, well, your own business and where that came from. That'd be cool.
Yeah, sure. I'll try and keep it as short as I can because I'm quite old now. Therefore, the background's a little bit longer.
Everyone likes the background, though. That's the thing.
When I left school, I started on a course in beauty therapy and I qualified in skincare and makeup and massage, aromatherapy, reflexology, all these different ologies and things. And I quickly went into teaching. So I have a background teaching at City of Bath College and Lowestoft College in East Anglia, and also what was Somerset College of Arts and Technology down in Taunton. But my job very quickly became the writing of exam structures and things like that, internal auditing, all the boring stuff that knits together a really big department. So I got quite good at bureaucracy at quite a young age. And then I ended up teaching in an all-male prison, because I had two young children and it kind of made sense that the prison was in town and it was something that I could do. And so I taught communication skills. So the prison closed down, I don't know, about 6 years ago. I did that from 1995 to 2001. But it also meant that I was subject to being audited by the Home Office and by Strode College, who were the education provider, and also by the prison itself. So I kind of became quite good at getting departments ready for audit. Because we were audited 3 times a year every year. It was just a nightmare. So there was a sort of bag of skills that came in then. And at the same time, when I was teaching at Bath College, I was approached by one of the directors of what was then Peter Black Toiletries, which then became Lee and Fung, and that's obviously now Mumier. So at the time I was approached, I had a group of students at Bath College who were studying beauty therapy, and they felt they would give some value added. Not only would they just score products, but they would, they would closely analyse them and write reams about how good they were or how bad they were. And so basically, I went to see a chap called Sterling Crew, who was really encouraging, and he's now more in food and beverages. But it was really encouraging, and I remember taking my two youngest children, who are now directors of the company, to a meeting with Sterling, and they just run ragged around his office and ruin absolutely everything. I was just sort of never going to go anywhere. I'm sacked before I've even started. But I went to him with a concept to say, yes, I can test your products on students, but I can't do that during my contact hours because I'm a qualified teacher. So I need to do it in my non-contact time. So put together a proposal of how I was going to actually migrate my business from teaching to doing consumer studies on students. This was back in the days when I was working on DOS. I had no idea how to use a computer. I had to get a friend from the local council officers who'd actually seen a computer. I'd never really seen one before, to come and show me how to use it. And I had one of those big floppy disks that I had to drive in my car from Shepton Mallet to Trowbridge and hand it in on the reception desk for them to be able to read off the results that I'd done on a calculator and typed in, you know. So it was all very, very Heath Robinson. And then I don't know, after doing that for 3 or 4 years, I clearly couldn't take my products into the prison and test them on inmates because they were for women of a certain calibre who shopped here and had that kind of skin type. So I kind of put it out there in the community and then had the sort of gestalt moment where I thought, I know exactly how to write a programme for this, for the fact that I don't write programmes. So I kind of wrote a route map for my website, which is called Ayton System Software. Took that to a developer who just got it. He just understood it. So we have the volunteer zone, which volunteers sign up on and profile themselves on. We've got 600,000-700,000 volunteers now all over the globe. We're in 35 countries, 25 languages. And then there's the client.
How do you recruit the volunteers?
Well, historically, I literally spent £2,000 the first year that the website was launched. And that was for a global campaign when the only way you could do it was through a specialist in SEO.
Okay.
And since then, I've never, ever had to run a campaign like that again, because our volunteers are genuinely not spammed. They genuinely get free products. They're genuinely full size. They don't have to send them back.
Yeah.
They can write the truth about the products. And they're not penalised in any way.
Wow.
So we've got a very, very honest panel. And if we want to grow the panel, we just ask the panel to grow the panel. So most of it is organic.
Okay, amazing.
Yeah, so that's kind of how we went from complete poverty to a life of, I wouldn't say luxury, but stability.
Yeah.
And all in all, that took about 27 years. So yeah, it was about 1995-ish when we took off big time. And then Karis came on board, and she's really converted things. So I'll let Karis talk about her role.
Yeah, so I actually joined AIDS and Global Research straight after, out of college. So, you know, we kind of were in a small town in Shepton Mallet.
What did you study at college, Karis?
It's a place called Strode, which is in the street. So it's just like rural summer there.
Okay. And what did you study?
And I studied performing arts, so nothing to do with what I'm doing now. Yeah. I didn't know what I wanted to do, so I'd got to know Sue, and so I came on board with her and was working as a study manager. And I did that for a year before going to university to study dance, funny enough, but carried on working part-time. And it was actually, you know, through studying dance, I loved to dance and things like that, but what I actually found really interesting was exactly what I've been doing at 18 Global Research, which is research. I loved researching all the sort of different books, writing my dissertation, conducting research, you know, on different types of dance style. And teaching as well, so learning about all the term teaching strategies that were involved in teaching dance. So after university, Sue offered me the job as training director for the company to come back on board, which obviously, like I said, I absolutely was completely in love with that, because I've been loving teaching, I've been loving research, and that was the absolute perfect pairing. And then so I was basically doing the training for all of the staff, but also for the clients, and found that there was a kind of gap in everyone's knowledge overall in terms of regulations, especially in the cosmetic industry, but also in all industries. So that was overall with the clients and how that married up, you know, with our staff's knowledge as well, because generally they're data protesting. They're not really thinking about the regulations that are at the end of it. That would be, you know, a consultant's job or something like that, who would tell the client in the first place. So I kind of wanted to bridge that gap and make sure that, you know, all of our clients that we're visiting understood the regulations about what we do, and how that would help them, you know, globally launching their products.
Yeah.
And also that our staff were understanding the regulations that were involved in the things they're putting on the system. So that's kind of all married up now. So I've become sort of regulatory specialist with the company. And I also say I'm kind of consumer research consultant, because I've kind of put myself forward as a bit of a consultant for the business as well. In terms of just giving a different service to the clients that we have, so as Sue said, sort of doing things like gap analysis, looking at products that are already on the market, seeing if the evidence is there, or if a product's being launched, seeing what, not just the tests that we do, but what tests need to be done overall to make sure it can be launched in those markets and with those claims, basically. And I just absolutely love it. I find it really interesting.
And that's because you really quickly found something you love doing, which was that researching and the studying thing.
Yeah, it's not a path I thought was going to go down. I was always very sort of creative person. But then I find this creative in its own right, you know, kind of making studies, choosing methodologies, choosing the right participants to test the right product for the right claims. So I think it is kind of, in a really weird way, married up.
That's why I find it really weird when people keep saying to me, do you love what you do? And or even a few years ago when I was trying to desperately find like what I love doing, because I was questioning if I wanted to be doing what I'm doing now, because brutally honest, I don't live and breathe beauty, despite my gorgeous looks and that kind of stuff. I like, it doesn't excite me, but really, it took me a while to actually understand I do really love business, and I love helping people in business. Like, I love bringing people on within our business. I love helping startups launch a business and stuff like that. So That's why it's really cool to hear that you really quickly found actually the skill bit that you love doing. Actually, yeah. That's really transferable. So even in the future, if you like, you know what you love doing, so it doesn't matter what field, or if you wanted to change fields, you can look at doing something like that. So Susan, when you were doing the teaching and the prison, like when it was all bureaucracy and stuff like that, did you love that that side?
I did, but in probably not a very healthy way.
Right.
I mean, nobody likes facts and figures, but I liked the achievement. I liked the kudos that it gave me in the department, I think. I wasn't a senior lecturer. I was just part-time. But I could see some issues. I did a lot of the safety assessments, which is quite challenging in an all-male prison. And especially at a time when smoking was allowed, for example, in your classroom. When you had to watch for really small things going missing, like pencils or anything that they could make a weapon out of and things like that. You know, I mean, it was an enormous challenge for me at the time. And I think I liked combining the reality of the situation with some kind of formal auditing process. And I think it gave my colleagues a lot of reassurance that, you know, you're working in an environment which is okay. Areas that aren't okay, I've raised them as issues. Before that, there wasn't even an audit system. Even when I started at the prison in 1995, that was one of the first times that we had an audit.
So
it was just quite interesting to see those days when things were starting to become formalized. And I think talking about skills transfer, I mean, Karis was saying that she's transferred her skills from her education module within her degree in choreography, which I have to say she came out with the first class honours in.
Nice.
Didn't mention that.
Modest as well. I would have been mentioning that immediately had I have not dropped out.
But I mean, you know, Karis has sort of taken that and she's been able to transfer that. And I think that's kind of what I've done really, is to say, well, it's a skill set that I've got, is kind of make a bit of order out of disorder. Whereas Karis is about taking a syllabus and imparting that onto her colleagues and making sure that they're all qualified or at least assessed in the skills that they need.
And
I was so interested in your podcast number one, because that came up time and time again.
With Mark,
and it just seems to be that until you've gained a variety of skills, maybe business isn't your thing. You need that breadth of experience to kind of bang it all together, have a concept and make it run.
Yeah, most definitely. I was a really fascinated one with Mark. That is,
yeah, I was really intrigued.
To get onto that bit, yeah, you've got to have the ups and downs and stuff, as well as the bureaucracy and the audit and stuff. Were there any really big challenges working in the prison with those type of people that you've taken into business?
Yeah, being a woman, that was an enormous challenge. You had to develop a really great sense of humour because you weren't ever going to win with discipline. And this was back in the days where my built-in cupboard in the back of my classroom didn't even have an alarm bell in it. So I raised that with one of my audits at one point. And you just kind of realised that you had to find a way of controlling a classroom. We had 14 on our roll. We had glass-walled classrooms. But you had to find a way of controlling them with humour. And so I watched a lot of Porridge and I developed my repertoire of jokes, you know, so you'd sort of do the register and go, oh, you're all here again today. Ah, you know, or the other nasty one was, oh, did you get out of bed the wrong side? Oh, no, you can't, can you?
I love the fact you've got all the skills for watching Porridge. That's amazing.
Yeah, so you kind of learn how to cope being in an all-male environment. And actually, low cosmetics has traditionally been a very girly thing. The earlier part of my career, 27 years ago, most of the people I was working with were men. You know, not in prison, but in boardroom meetings and so on. And it was challenging at the time. Now, you know, over 27 years, I see as many women as I do men, but I really didn't back then.
Yeah,
I remember saying that actually to my son, because he's another one of our directors. We're a family business, and I remember saying to him, "It's not it's not a very female business, actually, if you want to sort of use stereotypes.
Yeah.
You'll probably end up talking to more men than you will do women.
Yeah, no, I agree. We have had that conversation quite recently, actually, with a lot of people. There's a few people were assuming the business that I was in was very heavily dominated by females. And actually, from a manufacturing perspective, from the areas that I've been, it was very male-dominated. Through like the ops and manufacturing and all that kind of stuff, and even so much in the sales, but we've got about a 50-50 split now. I think our SMT is 60-40, I think, male to female, so that's getting there, and that's out of 10. So,
well, yeah. I just had a little picture come up on my Facebook, and it was my son and I in Moscow 7 years ago yesterday. And when we went to Moscow, we went to Intercharm, the big beauty exhibition there. And so he was 21 at that time, and nobody would talk to me because it was an all-male dominated, exhibition centre. Nobody would talk to me. And so I just took up the role of dragging my own bag around, my own trolley around, and let my son, age 21, do all the talking because they didn't want to talk to me.
Really?
Yeah, really. And actually, up until, I would say, about 4 years ago when I was in India doing some lecturing in Mumbai, you still got the same kind of thing, that, you know, that a lot of the men there didn't, they weren't as comfortable, and especially at Beauty World Middle East in Dubai. It's still really, you know, there are still different cultures that you have to acknowledge, and that's a massive challenge.
Who finds it more uncomfortable? Do they find it more uncomfortable that they have to talk to you, or do you find it more uncomfortable that they're not talking to you?
I don't find it uncomfortable, and going back to skills transfer, I think it is because of having done time in 6 years in Chatham Mallet prison, maybe, I don't know. I don't find much uncomfortable at all in business or life anymore. You get hardened to it. But no, I think it's sometimes the male culture, certainly in the Middle East, that I think they do find it uncomfortable, and it's changing so quickly, and it's so good to watch. But I think it's the men that are more uncomfortable, to be honest, than the women.
When you were lecturing then, who were you lecturing? Was that males or males and females?
It was a mixed audience. Mixed audience.
But so you still have males attending, even though they're going to be listening and hearing from a female.
Yeah, I mean, I still noticed that the audience was predominantly male for my Indian lectures. There was a more equal mix, shall we say, than perhaps in some other countries.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really good to see now we've got cosmetics executive women and the Women's Business Award scheme and things like that. It's great to see that there's more of an even playing field. Shall we say. Yeah, I've lived some interesting moments.
It sounds it.
With this movement of the change in power or responsibility or the ability to get promoted for women. And of course, there are a lot of women or female instigated beauty brands now, which is great. I mean, Huda Beauty is an amazing example of that, where they're catering to the halal sector, and it's headed up by a woman. Just a fantastic example. Yeah,
have you had any probably not quite like that, Keris, but have you had any challenges in the job that you're in now?
I must say I've been really, really lucky, and I always think that generally, and since I've sort of started working, it's sort of very professional. This is the only kind of professional job I've ever had, if you know what I mean. I've worked there for a long time, and this is what I've done. But like I said, a lot of my job are always going to client meetings and going to other countries and things like that. And generally, I've always been really well accepted, especially like I do think, even when I was younger, sort of like 22 years old, and going to a business meeting by myself, you know, with some of the biggest maybe brands in New York and beauty brands, and kind of being in front of sort of a big audience like that, and I still think I was well accepted even as a young woman. So I do think I've kind of come into the industry at the right time, and maybe into business as a whole, I don't have the same struggles that I know that a lot of other women have had. Yeah. I know that they're still out there. I'm not saying they're not. I'm just saying that in the industry I work in, I think I've been really, really lucky that I've always been taken very seriously.
That's good.
But I think also you get what you give in terms of, I mean, like I said, not every situation's the same, but I think there's a certain, if you've got a certain respect for the people that you're meeting and talking with, you'll tend to get that back. Like I said, not maybe not every situation, but certainly the situations that I've been in,
Yeah.
I think I've always really proud of myself on my kind of people skills. So maybe that's a part of it as well. I think, yeah, I think everything's different. I think we're in a really good kind of time in this industry in particular. Like I said, I think there's a huge balance of male and female. I think looking at kind of my client basis, I think there's, I'd almost say it's 50-50 generally,
yeah,
of who's male and female and things like that.
Oof.
And loads of different cultures as well. Even in the UK, there's loads of brands that I work with that have got a very different cultural background. So yeah, I think the whole world is really going the right way. Maybe not kind of in certain countries, if you go there, maybe their culture is different in their own country. But I think certainly there are certain countries that have a very mixed culture. Yeah.
Nice, exciting. How do you, so going into those meetings when you were just 21, and it's great that people gave you respect, but that's got to be a lot about your confidence. Is that down to your performing arts background as well, do you think, why you had the confidence? Because I remember when I was 21, well, I wasn't, when I was 21, I was a complete and utter bum. So I wasn't even doing any work, I don't think, at that point. But when I started in this industry and going into like account management and going to meetings, I must have been about 27, I think, something along those lines. But I used to, even when I was with people initially, I used to feel really self-conscious, feel myself going red with embarrassment and stuff like that. But you sound like you've just walked into there with these global brands, like just breezing it. So
no, I definitely, don't get me wrong, I definitely, even to this day, I still get nervous. There might be a certain company I've wanted to work with for a long time and I got to go into that office and it still makes me nervous. But I think you're right. I mean, I think, you know, a lot of, especially doing sort of dance and things like that, a lot of it was audition based. So you're going into a room of people you don't know, competing against other people to be the person that stands out.
Yeah.
And maybe there is a certain part of that that really has helped me with that. And even things like kind of hosting webinars and things like that that we do, a lot of it is a performance. You know, you want to make it entertaining. You want to sort of know what you're talking about, be really, really confident, and have the confidence to say when you don't know what you're talking about as well. I think that's one thing that's always saved me a lot.
Yeah.
The worst thing is to try and wing it and sort of go, I think it's this. If I don't know something, I'm just really honest. I don't know that, but I'll look into it for you and find that out.
Yeah, big fan.
That's always helped.
Big fans. But and then when you get, so you're confident, why were you nervous going in? Even so, if it's a big brand that you've been really excited to work with and you cracked it, like, or not cracked it, you've got an opportunity, why would you be nervous at that point?
I think that's just a general human thing. It's like, okay, I hope they like me.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I get that even meeting a friend.
That's like, it. It's not even about what you're about to talk about.
You, oh yeah, like me. I'm sure, yeah, definitely. I mean, obviously, like what I'm selling as well, but, you know, if people don't like you, then you're not going to be able to sell anything. So I think you take it quite personally. I definitely do. I take that's almost a real downfall that I have, and I know Sue knows that as well. I take everything incredibly personally. Like, my work is my pride, yeah, completely. So if I'm selling something and they don't like it, I assume they don't like me.
I feel that. I definitely feel that as well. And despite what I say to people about it's nothing personal, you can, if you care, it's like you can't have it both ways, can you? Because I think if you really want to do a good job, you have to care.
Mm.
But if you really genuinely care, then you are going to take things personally if it doesn't work out.
Absolutely, yeah.
I've definitely been there. Do you have those struggles, Susan?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, especially in the early days, you know, we founded our business on, our first customer, apart from the contract manufacturer, was Marks & Spencer. That was a big quantum leap from teaching at Bath College or Taunton College, or the prison indeed. You know, it was a big leap to actually go into a completely different commercial environment.
Yeah.
Nothing commercial about teaching whatsoever. You know, it's a very steady job. It's very secure. There'd have to be something horrendous go wrong to lose your job as a lecturer, especially in FE, where you're not, you don't have behavioural challenges from your pupils or students. So yeah, the early days were really quite frightening. I think I would have been mortified if they didn't like my concept. I'm a very ideas-based person. And when I'd kind of got this concept about what I wanted to make in the way of a website, actually Tesco's got it immediately. And they started to use our service when we'd only got our volunteer zone built. the other side of it, the client zone. I was still delivering by snail mail or email. But they really understood it. And then that felt like a massive responsibility. So I think I would have been more personally insulted if they didn't like my concept rather than if they didn't like me as a person. But I mean, I remember meetings in the old days when people had a bit more time, about 20 years ago, and I would be 2 hours in a meeting selling what we do in to a team. And that was nothing. And of course, today, you're lucky if you get a half an hour window, and especially lucky if you get a meeting room. Some of the blue chips that we deal with, you might get a corner in an office.
Yeah.
I quite like that, actually. You know, it used to be like the entire development team that I'd be delivering my lecture to. And so, yeah, you could, there were challenges with that. I would have took it personally if they didn't like my idea, because I just knew it was the best way to deliver what
was
they needed.
Was anyone else doing anything close to what you were doing back then?
Not at all. I mean, even now, I think we've won our fourth research and development tax grant for Ayton Systems software. So it's my software. We don't. It's not anybody else's third-party software. We developed it ourselves. And we get that grant because it's still innovative. It has to be innovative to be able to achieve aspects of that grant. So I know what I have is still all bells and whistles compared to other people's models. Loads and loads of people, of course, do online research. But we've got the biggest database of verified, fully profiled panelists in the UK, but not enough people know that yet. And now we need to get off our backsides and tell them, because we're going to be slightly quieter at the moment. So we need to shout about what we actually do and what we do well. You know, every day is a challenge with it. We're still at the cutting edge of technology in our field, definitely. Many, many people... or companies are doing much better than us in pure market research, that's for sure, but not in consumer studies. We've learned the hard way. I mean, one of our biggest challenges, outside of having to stay in some appalling accommodation when our travel budget wasn't quite so rich, is customs and export. I mean, it's just horrendous when you get somebody's development stuck in Bangalore. You've literally got to get somebody to cycle down there, and you've only visited the country twice, and argue with them about getting this consignment out. These are the sorts of nitty-gritty challenges that we have to face. So we've kind of become expert in distribution specifically for cosmetics and toiletries all over the world. And I think that's been quite a challenge, hasn't it, Karis? Trying to learn all the ways that the ways that we can get products from A to B.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it can still be a challenge in terms of, you know, what's going on now with COVID-19. Obviously, I don't want to get too hung up on it. But yeah, absolutely, because we've gone from we were distributing products to Russia, for example, and a day after we sent the last consignment to go be tested, the Royal Mail cut them off. Really? So we were so lucky. Obviously, now we have to wait again for any more. But that, you know, that particular study... that we had to get out for our client, that we got on the last day. Same with India, we had samples that actually still with, we've got a partner who helps with us with distribution there. They've got the client samples, but they can't get them to the volunteers right now.
Right. And are your customers quite understanding of this? Because
absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, how can't you? I mean, it's really not anyone's fault. This is a global pandemic. Everything to do that, and to be fair, everything else is running as normal. It's literally those two countries that we're having, you know, slow. It's not going to stop, it will happen. They just got to wait a bit longer, unfortunately. It's out of our hand. And generally, you know, everything else is running as normal, which is great. It's more for our client side if they've got any hold ups on their end at that point. Distribution's always fun. Especially for new countries, because as well, I mean, there's so many countries that we might not even done a study in before, but we always say yes. Essentially, if we've got a client that wants to do a study in a country, we haven't got a panel there necessarily at that time, we will find volunteers, we will get your products there, and we will get them tested. That's very much how, you know, how we work. There's almost every year there's probably something new that we haven't come across before. So there's always some challenges, but it's good fun working them out.
It's all the data, you know, when you're sending them out to like Russia and stuff like that, and you're doing a certain test for a client. Is there ever, you don't own that test result, that's the client, is it?
Yeah, I mean, it's
until it's paid for. So.
Yeah, sure. But is there ever a point where you get an inquiry from another customer and you think, oh, we've done something similar to that. Maybe they'd share the data, or you have to, you literally just, it's all bespoke.
They're all bespoke because obviously we do the research based on the product that's being tested and the claims that are being tested. So every single study is completely unique. There's no two alike. I mean, we have people sort of say, you know, have you got sort of a template questionnaire we can use for this product? But my always example there is like, I could give you a template questionnaire, I could make one up, but why are you doing the research if you don't know what questions you
that's a good point.
It's, you know, it's based on the claims, it's based on your key market. So I think especially, you know, we get sort of people that contract manufacture for other brands, maybe, and they're like, can you put the study through Aiton Research?
Yeah.
And that's when they'll kind of be like, oh, have you got a basic questionnaire? But you know, the thing is, we're always happy to design the questionnaires. If they're, you know, we don't have to give you a template, but you let me know your claims, you let me know who you want to test it on, you let me know everything about the product, and I'll make you a really good questionnaire about it that'll get you those really good claims. So yeah, that's kind of how we avoid the kind of scope for sharing, you know, research. It's all very bespoke.
And with when you were talking about Tesco's and Marks and Spencer, when you were new and you were starting out, how did you especially because it was a brand new thing that people weren't doing, people's time, I know people have got less and less time now, it seems, whenever you want meetings and stuff like that, but even then people were still a bit more, they didn't want meetings for the sake of just having a meeting, did they? So how did you convince them that what you were doing they need to hear and getting your
I think I just talked until they fell asleep and thought, we better say yes and get her out. You know? Yeah. Probably leave breathless and blue in the face, because there was just so much, there is still so much that the software can do. And it was really hard to get across all of the things that it can do. It's basically like the shape of a Diablo, if you like, where one end of it is volunteer facing. Or tester facing, and then the other side of the Diablo is the customer facing, so something that Marks and Spencer or Body Shop or Oriflame can log into, and they've got a window into that study in real time. And then the middle bit is what my staff do to make this bit look like this and that bit look like that, and to try and explain that and all the permutations of it took some time. I mean, for example, we can upload an online focus group where we record the scene just as we are today.
Sure.
But we can also allow our customer to be the augmenter of that session, so it doesn't need to be us that does that, and then they can also then immediately download the video and analyze it to pieces, they can, at leisure, you know. And then after that session, assuming that we've sent a product into the home of those volunteers, the volunteers can continue and do a quantitative study after they've already had that experience of being filmed opening it and their first reaction to, you know, smelling the texture and so on. They can then continue and say, well, after 7 weeks, my skin looked like this, or my hands looked like that. After 14 weeks, my skin looked like that, my hands looked like that. So we can kind of do qualitative, quantitative. We can do it in a store. I remember one store wanting us to go in to assess basically the new layout of the store and how it would work versus the old layout, and we can do that. We went up to Covent Garden Spa. We did an incredible in-salon study there where we liaised with all of the therapists en masse and their clientele. And so we actually got the therapists as well as the clients to fill in a questionnaire about the experience of this wonderful treatment that they had developed. You know, so it can be absolutely anything. Sometimes we just get a thumbnail of a product design, a packaging design, and we might be able to turn that around in 24 hours, and people will just look at a series of thumbnail images and preference rank them and say, well, I like this one best, this one best.
Oh, brilliant. So, or, really varied.
I don't know, it's just so varied. I mean, the other one was a baby care range where they said, we don't know what to put on our strap line. We know what we know what we want to call the baby care range, but we need a strap line. So we threw it out to some new mums and said, what do you want to read at the bottom of it? And they came up with the creative, and then we gave it back to the designer. So it's hard to kick me out of a meeting, really.
No, I get like that when you're talking about something you really care about, you just go for it, don't you? You keep going. So when you're doing the video call, have you been using video calls for a long time then in your business?
Yeah. I mean, the video calls that we do, if we're running a focus group, are completely integrated with the concept of a study or a study instance. So, for example, if we had 100 products and we split them up amongst four panels of 25, we could have 25 in America, 25 in Japan, 25 in Italy, 25 in the UK. And we can get various different study managers to manage those populations and then kind of download the video and then continue with the integrated quantitative assessment of the product after that experience is finished. So how long is a piece of string, really? It's almost like a Rubik's Cube, the software. You can sort of augment it in any direction you want to achieve what you want. Nice. Like Karis was saying, we don't do anything off the shelf. When somebody's poured about between 80,000 and £100,000 into the development of one SKU, which is what I hear the going rate is for a startup brand, they hardly want to just have 14 questions off a shelf that we might have used with six different ice cream retailers. You know, we like to learn. We're really intrigued by exactly what we're doing today. We like to learn what has made somebody start that brand up and what their background is and what their passion is and what markets they think they're going to sell in. And once we really get inside their head, that's when we can come out with a really, really great study design. And it's not just a sales spiel, but we literally have been able to make claims that have taken people from selling in a local salon or something to having an international deal. Because we also know where people shop, you see. We know what brands they like and what their budget is. And so we can really help to steer our clients to say, you know what, you should take that brand to this high street store. That's or to incredible. This institute. You kind of get contacts on all sides, don't you?
Yeah.
And I love that idea that you were saying about, you know, business is really about, it's about connecting people, isn't it? We sort of had a preamble to this interview. Yeah. It's about connecting people and sort of matching people and their skill sets up. And I think that's kind of what we do in our business in a way. Run studies, that's what we sell, but really what we're doing is connecting people's enthusiasm with their skill sets.
I like how you understand the enthusiasm though as well, because we get leads coming through like via email. And it'd be really quick just to fire off another email, but we try and speak to everyone that literally comes just to understand a bit more about their brand. And we just want the fit to be right, really. Because you work a long time, don't you? So you want business to be as fun as possible. Have you got how many people in your business and how big's your, do you have a premises?
We have a premises. That's where we do all of our pick and pack. Obviously, we've had to convert things to have a quarantine area. That happened way back in January. We're lucky in that our software allows the rest of the team, there's 14 of us all together.
Okay.
So the study managers, the team of study managers who get to know the clients and extract that story from them and build up that picture of what their aspirations are, they're all now busy working on my software from their homes.
Okay.
But the packers obviously have to have a physical environment. And it's kind of, we've been so lucky with this COVID situation in that where the office has been vacated by the study managers to work at home, we've now got capacity to have three separate packing rooms. So we can still put the throughput through. But our packer, Katie Summers, her name is, and I have to say, her and Jack, who are the last two who are actually office-based still during this crisis, need the most massive round of applause because they've just been absolutely amazing. The only elasticity has been my other daughter, who's been able to go in and help in the third packing room.
Oh, okay.
But they've really churned some stuff out.
How do you stay in touch with everyone?
As teams mainly. My son Rob has sort of managed all the comms, and we were by coincidence almost there just before this kind of hit.
Yeah.
We were there in terms of Microsoft in general and all of our email comms. And then we'd literally just put Teams into place as a working model. Just before Christmas, we were just starting to feel around saying, well, what's a bucket? You know, how do we operate a bucket on Teams? What's the difference between that and a task list and things? Yeah, so we were just sort of feeling our way around that when the crisis hit. And so I get notifications every 2 or 3 minutes. I've had to turn them off for this.
I've turned off now.
Yeah. So we have like a channel for Packers to talk to study managers. And so that's pinging all the time, backwards and forwards. Then we have a channel which is just for management. And that's pinging backwards and forwards. We don't have one for clients. Clients we're on a sort of one-to-one with, so we kind of match up a study manager with the right skill set, say for an international blue chip client, or a study manager who's really good at doing startup beauty brands with a new client. So that's all sort of done mostly by email and telephone, really. And of course, up until, when did we do our Northern tour, Karis? Was that January?
That was February, I think. We actually came and seen some of your staff as well.
We did. I think you were one of
the last. Did you?
Yeah. I think that's our last tour, yeah.
Well, who did you see? Laura?
We saw Laura, yeah.
Oh, good.
Yeah. Last time we ever saw a cosmetic chemist.
Yeah, honestly, it probably is. That's probably the last meeting we actually managed to do physically.
Oh, really?
Before I went, I think, yeah, because, literally from then, because I went on holiday and came back to lockdown. So that was the last one.
Did you manage to fulfil the holiday, or were you sent back early?
I did. It was very lucky. No, we weren't in lockdown here. It's just a lot of other places start going to lockdown.
Okay.
So we chose to, for myself and other people that come on holiday with me, other members of staff, to all just start working from home from then, because we kind of knew what was going to happen.
Yeah.
And we'd been through international airports. We'd actually been up in the mountains. So we weren't anywhere at high risk. Not in Italy, in the Czech Republic. Because that's the Italy started closing down at that moment. We just kind of went, we can work from home. We're able to do it. We can use the software. We started trialing out everything that the whole team's ended up taking over, really, in terms of all the procedures and stuff. So I've been working at home from the end of February, actually.
How are you finding it?
I'm absolutely fine. I live with two other people who are also working from home. So that's quite nice. We've got big gardens. So we're very lucky. It's not too bad at all.
Oh, nice. Do you normally work from home, Susan?
Yeah, I've worked from home since slightly before 2015.
Oh, okay.
I had there was a massive challenge that I forgot to bring up. I had a craniotomy in 2015. I had a crash on my way home from a corporate meeting with Tesco's on the M25. Got took to St George's Hospital back in London, and it's like, why am I going here when I live in the southwest? And they said, oh, we think you've broken your spine. Put me through a scanner, and they said, oh no, it's okay, you haven't broken your spine, but you've got a great big brain tumor. But it was benign, and they operated on it in 2015. And so I started to work at home from then onwards, really. In fact, right from my hospital bed, really. Just can't got to do something, you know, and I quite enjoy my job, as you can tell. So it became a thing, really. I found I could focus more, and obviously there was a lot of rehab, particularly where thought processes were concerned, and speech, and marrying up concepts and articulating things and being able to sort of regurgitate them. It was all very sort of like swimming through jelly, so I'm quite accustomed to working from home. I don't think because I'm in contact all the time with the staff through Teams and Skype and other, you know, other measures. I still feel like I'm sort of intimately involved with the staff. And we do a lot socially, don't we, Karis? We have some really great, crazy team building days. And I think that's what we're really missing at the moment.
About this time every year, we usually do some sort of outside sport or something all together. So.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah.
And how many, 14 people, did you say?
Yeah, we did paddle boarding on Bristol docks the last time. It was such a great laugh, you know. None of us had one of us had done paddle boarding before. Jack had done it before, but he went in the drink. I went in the drink.
You haven't you? If it's going to be a fun event day like that, we every year we try and do the same. But we've got 200 people now. But we have
oh my goodness!
And I don't know how it's going to go this year. But we had it booked, and in fact, we just postponed it. So we will do something, but we might have to do it in four groups if they limit it to like mass gatherings of 50 or less. But we do a sports day. We have like a summer party, and Verity, our HR manager, she breaks up all the teams, so it's completely random across every single department. And then
you nominate
a team captain. So all the senior managements are separated, which is cool. You nominate a team captain, and then it's super competitive. It's like it's a knockout. And it goes on all day, and there's like mental games, physical games. And we've been quite blessed, actually. It's always been quite sunny when we've been doing it in the summer. And then we just have a beautiful Christmas party. But we're trying to think about what we can do throughout the year. But when you've got so many people, it becomes harder and harder.
We kind of compete with ourselves, trying to think of wilder and wilder things to do. I think my favourite one was, because we're all hopeless on a horse, apart from Katie Alpaca, we did a corporate jockey day. It was just hilarious. And it's right on the doorstep of our offices, and there's a school called Dubocchi Riding School. And it's such a lot of fun, and it's for novices all the way through to racehorse jockeys. And so I think, were there three teams, Karis? Three or four
teams? Yes, three teams. Oh, it was so funny.
That sounds awesome. That's the bit I miss about like the littler teams, where you can do stuff like that. But we're trying to think of like splitting the teams up, so you can get a group out for a day and do like, you know, those escape rooms and things like that. And
Yeah, they did, yeah. I mean, I think like, we usually do a Pilton party as well, which is the local for the locals for Glastonbury Festival. A local event a couple of months later, and I don't think that's going to happen this year, saying that, because we usually do that every year. There's all the teams sort of go for a big sort of outside festival as well. So yeah, it's all those little things this year we're going to miss, really.
And even outside of the team event for Pilton Party, a large number of us, we have to close down for one or two days either side of the big one, i.e. Glastonbury Festival.
Okay.
Because the movement of traffic is very difficult, and you know, a lot of our staff want to go, so we can cycle to Glastonbury from where we live. You can imagine how popular it is, and of course it's not happening this year. So these are the things that we're missing, I think. In terms of the day-to-day operation of the business, communication, feeling supported, I hope all of those things are still sort of in place, but we do miss each other. We do, don't we?
Yeah, like when you've got a team like you've got, where you're doing all this stuff together, it's going to be really challenging, isn't it? I miss seeing people. Yeah, I imagine other people are feeling very fortunate I'm not there all the time, walking around just saying hi and giving everyone a really inappropriate high five or a fist pump or something like that, thinking I'm still in my early 20s rather than just about to turn 40.
And are you missing the exhibitions? I mean, have you got like a contingency plan yourself? Because I'm worried that they're not actually going to continue to happen in the... I mean, you look at Cosmoprof, 21 halls times two stories times about 100 exhibitors per hall.
Yeah.
People flying in from all over the world. I mean, I just can't see that happening for quite a while now.
Yeah, no, we don't exhibit really anymore, actually. We tend to visit just so it's a great place so we can see more people. But I think Laura and her team, they do a lot of the formulation ones, like in COS and a few other ones, and we go to a lot of seminars just about regulatory and stuff like that. So Paulina, who's super talented in our team from a regulatory perspective, she can just take in a seminar or take in a big manual and condense it down in a way that I can understand it really, really quickly. So that's a talent in itself. But I think we'll definitely miss going to some exhibitions, but it's not massively important so much, I don't think, for our business.
I think it'd be the air travel for us. I mean, Karis and I have stayed in many different countries. And before Karis came along, random members of staff, not random people, but, you know, in a random fashion, with well-known members of staff in a random fashion, make sure of that opportunity to come travel with me and feedback to the team what it was like when they went to Italy or when they went to Spain or you know, all these other countries that we've been to. And that's going to be hard to really get your ear to the ground without being able to do that travel for a couple of years. Part of our visits overseas are always to go shopping. We always go to McDonald's. We always bring
them very cultured
because we want to be able to see what the differences are between one McDonald's and another. So I've been to McDonald's in Shanghai and in Italy and in France, everywhere I go, because, you know, that we do studies that cater for national preferences, and McDonald's are very, very good at it.
Right.
So then we go to shopping malls, and we find out, for example, in Dubai, we know which shopping malls are for the workers, which are for the rich, and which for the super duper rich, and so on. And that's a great way for us to profile our volunteers. So if somebody's aspiration is to get their product in a particular shopping mall in Dubai, then best we run our study on people who have got a loyalty card for that particular shopping mall. But, you know, to do that online is just grunt work. But when you're actually over there and you're seeing a ski center in a shopping mall in Dubai, yes, and a two-story fish tank in another shopping mall in Dubai, that's exciting. You know, that's just exciting. And getting the vibe of the shoppers and learning how they shop differently than in the UK. I mean, it's a very family affair in Dubai. You don't get people wandering around solo shopping. They always go in a great big group, and it's lovely, and that's a really sociable thing for them to do. Doing all of this textbook or this kind of research on the internet that gives us the insight into how to help our customers being successful is going to be a challenge. Are we actually going to do that? Are we going to sit down and watch street cams of, you know, people's behaviour over the next year or two? Or are we going to risk it and continue to travel? I just don't have the answer.
I love meeting people, and that's been massive, especially while I've been at Orion, like face-to-face meetings and meeting over lunch and dinner and things like that. And part of, I don't do quite as much as I used to now, but part of the bit I'm concerned about is that more and more people, just because Zoom becomes the norm, that they don't feel that you need that interaction anymore. And
that's my worry.
Be like this. And I think it's been amazing when you have to use stuff like this. And I think if you need a quick answer on something, I'd much rather now Zoom someone than just phone them up. I'd rather just see the face and have a quick chat. And some of our customers, they think I'm mental. I've been trying to FaceTime them for months leading up to this. Even some of my team at work, they're like, "Why are you FaceTiming me? I'm just about to get on the tube." And I'm like, "Just saying hi." So I've been like prepping for this for what feels like forever. But you just still can't miss that human interaction, can you?
A meal. I mean, the meals that Karis and I have had, oh my God, we've just had some amazing meals. And I'm going to really miss that. And not the actual food, but the social side. We've made some really good friends.
Yeah, you do, though, don't you? And you learn so much more about people when you can just have a chat outside of an office, and it feels a lot more natural, doesn't it?
Absolutely, yeah.
The next time you're up, you've got to make sure you let me know so I can actually meet you whenever that might be. Well, thanks for your time. I'm conscious of taking up loads of your time, haven't I? But,
that's fine. So I do need to run away because I have actually got another call at 4:30.
Yeah, cool. No problem. Thank you. Thanks, Karis. Thanks, Sue.
Thank you so much, though. I really enjoyed that, and it's really lovely to sort of get to know you a bit better. And I said, hopefully we'll be able to come see you at some point.
Cool. Thanks, both. I really appreciate it.
Cheers. Thank you.
Really good. Enjoyed it. Thank you. Bye-bye.